Good morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order 30th of January, 2024, 2 minutes after 9 a.m. With me today is Co-Chair Hoffman, Co-Chair Olson. Senator Bishop will not be attending. He's excused. Senator Merrick, Senator Keel, Senator Wilson, and myself, Stedman. Before we get rolling, today there's an extra handout, a little glossy chart of the proposed budget and last year's enacted management plan. And as we go through the process this year, we most likely will update that. That document was put together by Ledge Finance. We inadvertently left that off the document. It wasn't created by some secret entity. And there's some handouts on the table back there for those that want to have a copy of it. We refer to this as the placemat because it's kind of handy, but it puts the budget in scale, what we're dealing with. And I think it'll be helpful. And we'll, like I said, update that over time. So today, we're going to continue some discussion dealing with retirement systems. And we're going to talk about the TERS and PERS, the public employees and the teachers' retirement systems, updating funding status. So with us today from the Division of Retirement and Benefits, we have Ajay Desai, the director, Kevin Worley, the chief financial officer, and Kathy Lee, the chief pension officer. And if they could come forward however they want to do it, and then we'll go through their presentation, and we'll do the standard process of each slide, and then we'll have questions, and we'll just work our way through. And we'll be working on this subject matter, I'm sure, over the next couple of months. So this will give us some background. And then maybe introduce yourself for the record, and the department can take it away.
Thank you, Chair Stedman. Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Ajay Desai, Division Director for Retirement and Benefits. With me, I have Chief Pension Officer Kathy Lee.
Yeah. I'm Kathy. For the record, I'm Kathy Lee, Chief Pension Officer.
Just to let you know, Kathy Lee was retired in April of 2020 during the COVID period. And after 3 years, we brought her back at the right time. Also with me, Mr. Kevin Worley.
Good morning. Kevin Worley, Chief Financial Officer for the Division of Retirement and Benefits. And additionally, we have on the phone David Kirshner, who works with Buck Global. He's our consulting actuary, the firm that does the actuarial valuation reports for the public employees and teacher retirement systems.
Okay. Starting with the presentation, page number 2. This shows the organization chart, how Department of Revenue, Alaska Retirement Management Board, otherwise known as ARM Board, and Department of Administration, Division of Retirement and Benefits, work together throughout the year to manage the PERS and TERS fundings and actuarial analysis. Moving on to slide number 3, I'll hand it over to Mr. Worley.
Again, good morning, Kevin Worley, Chief Financial Officer. On slide 3 is the membership data that we have as of June 30, 2023, which is also the date of the next actuarial valuation reports, which we'll be discussing in draft form throughout this presentation. Currently within the PERS, active membership is 25%. Defined benefit actives and 75% for the defined contribution plan. It took about 10 years to switch over from more DB to DC. About 2016 is when we made that first switch on the PERS side. On TERS, we're looking at 31% actives versus a 69% active on the defined contribution plan. There's no questions on slide 3. We'll move on to slide number four, which is the investment experience related to the PERS and TERS plans. These are based on fiscal year. So looking at fiscal year 2022 and 23, we have an assumed actuarial valuation rate of 7.25%. This was recently adopted by the ARM board in conjunction with the 22 valuation reports. It was a change. This is a change from 7.38% prior to that. We did do an experience study that ended for the 22 period and made that, the ARM board did adopt that rate. Based on fair value of assets during 22, we had a negative 6% rate of return. And as we've previously expressed in different meetings that we've had here, we do use a five-year rolling average for assets, where we smooth the assets over a five-year period as opposed to looking at the big swings that could occur. We, again, use a five-year smoothing. So during fiscal year 23, which is currently in a draft process and going through the ARM board for adoption in June of this year, fair value of assets, we had a return of 7.6% compared to an actuarial smooth value of assets of 7.4%.
So on this slide, can you help us with a little more detail on the smoothing and why we should pay attention to the smoothing and also pay attention to the fair market value? What's going on with those?
I'm sure. Actually, I have my actuary online, so I'll be happy to introduce David Kirshner. David, if you could go ahead and answer that question.
And Mr. Kirshner from Buck, could you help the committee remind them about the actuarial smoothing and the fair market value, and kind of keep in mind in your questions that we're really directing the answers to the public more so than the committee, which is much more familiar with these subject matters than the general public.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi, this is David Kirshner, retirement actuary with Buck. We don't use the market value of assets to determine the funding contributions because of the volatility of the market value. You can see, for example, in year ending 2022, it was a minus 6%, and the year before, in year end 21, it was a 30% return, the market return, and then we had 23 at 7.6. So because the market value of assets is so volatile, subject to the markets, we use what's called an actuarial value of assets, which recognizes the gains and losses on the market values over a five-year period. So every year, we recognize 20% of each of the market value gain or loss in determining our actuarial value of assets, and that helps us smooth out the impacts of the market volatility. Otherwise, we would have contributions going up and down. They would go way up when we have a bad market return and way down when we have a good market return. So that's what the actuarial value of assets is introduced to remove that volatility.
Okay. We have any other questions? Just for those watching at home, it's very similar to the permanent fund. We calculate the 5% payout over a five-year smoothing. The next slide, I guess, slide number five.
Okay. Moving on to slide five. This is purely an informational slide. This is a combination of the pension and healthcare for the funded status of the plan. And just as a reminder, funded status is, in terms of percentage, the value of plan assets divided by the measure of the obligations that that particular plan is responsible for. As you recall, within the PERS and TERS, we have two different trusts. One deals with pension and one deals with the healthcare component. Currently, what's reflected on here, again, is a combined method, information only. And we do not, in rate calculations, combine the values of these. So as we'll see in subsequent slides, the pension plan is underfunded, the health plan is overfunded, and we cannot take any overfunding from one plan and use it to assist in the underfunding of another plan. And again, we'll see that on the next couple slides.
Hey, could you tell us why we can't do that? Why we can't just take the overfunding and healthcare and put it to the underfunding and in pension and right off into the sunset?
You want to hit that or do you want me to? Want me to? Okay. So because these are separate trusts, what's in the trust can only be used for that particular obligation. So the pension trust can only be funded and used for pension payments. Same with the healthcare. Those are we pre-fund both of these plans, and the obligations that are incurred for each of these plans are distinct and separately accounted for and funded for. So there was a court case, and it's totally slipping my mind right now. I apologize for that. But the case in particular looked at trust funds that were underfunded. There were three different tiers, and one of those tiers happened to be overfunded, and it was determined that an overfunding from one plan could not be used for the underfunded of other plans. And that is how these valuation reports are prepared, looking at the funded status of each separately. This particular slide is just a carryover from prior presentations that we have provided before, and periodically we get asked what is the funded status of the plan, and I think people overall look at a funded status for PERS as both pension and healthcare. We do have to qualify that subsequently that you're looking at two different funded statuses, one for pension, one for health.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On line F, the unfunded actuarial accrued liabilities in 2021 was a little north of $500 million. Now, today the draft is 3.7. Does that give the department any concern on the direction that this unfunded actuarial is going?
Through the chair to Senator Hoffman, we'll see slides here coming up, bar charts, as well as the additional slides related to pension and healthcare. There's a trend that we look at when we're developing the actuarial valuations and then the funding for those. And one of that is funding status. We also look at the funded levels, but we have a plan in place through the ARM board where calculations are done by our actuary. We look at the funded status, and then through the legislative process, we go about funding those. So even though these are going in a different direction, 21 was particularly, as David said, it was a 30% year. And then we had a negative 6% year. So on a fair value basis, which is what you were looking at on line F, again, that is an informational. We fund more on line C, which is the unfunded actuarial accrued based on actuarial value of assets.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And if we ask a question that would be better answered in a future slide, just let us know.
Oh, yes, sir.
And we'll, keep everything in order. Any other questions on committee on the combined? Okay, we'll go on to slide 6, please.
All right. Moving on to slide 6, this is the defined benefit pension, so the DB pension plans for both PERS and TERS. And again, these are based on fiscal year, June 30. So again, the funded status here, you're seeing in the case of PERS, we're right at 67-68%. That hasn't changed much. The 2023 draft was just presented at the December ARM board meeting. We do have a March meeting coming up, and we'll begin the review process as set in statute. Buck is the administration's actuary, and then the ARM board has their own actuary, which is Gabriel Roeder-Smith. So they're going through that process. Based on the draft information, though, that we see here, we've been pretty consistent over the last 3 years. But ultimately, the plan is to get to the 100% funded level. That is how we base the valuation reports and the funding status.
So could you tell us this, talk a little bit about the draft numbers for 23 on PERS and then TERS. And what is this line C and line F? And do we?
Okay, be happy to. So, for example, looking at PERS, So the actuarial accrued liability is the present value of future pension benefit payments and for current and future retirees. The actuarial value of assets, as David explained, is a five-year smooth asset value, and the unfunded liability is the difference at that particular time. And we're only looking at one period in time here. We do this calculation annually. So as of a point in time, June 30, we were at 5.6 unfunded on the pension plan using actuarial value of assets. Fair value of assets is that the value of assets based on market at the end of the fiscal year. There's a slightly less than the actuarial value of assets, and we're at right at $5.7 billion of unfunded. On the TERS side, the actuarial accrued liability for just the pension is $8 billion. The actuarial value of assets, or the smooth value of assets, which we base funding on, is at 6.2 for an unfunded of 1.9. Based on fair value of assets, we're just a little bit above that. Funded ratios are generally pretty close in this case. But again, the plan is for the funding of this plan to get approximately 100% funded by 2039. That continues to be the goal of the ARM board and the administration.
So can we talk a little bit about the history? How long has this liability been hanging around? And what was it 17 years ago, roughly, when we started trying to pay the debt off?
And we'll actually be getting to a slide on that. We have a bar chart that relates to the unfunded liabilities for both pension and trust.
Over time?
Over time.
Okay.
All right. Any questions on slide six?
So just briefly, are we going forward or backwards on our unfunded liability from 21 through the draft of 23? Just over that short snapshot of time?
As we'll see in a future chart, we're about at a plateau at this point. It's been kind of moving up and down a little bit. Okay. So, but we'll see a pictorial of that in an upcoming graph. Okay. Moving to slide seven. So slide seven shows the funded status of the healthcare trust related to PERS and TERS. And again, we're looking at draft financials information as of June 30, 2023, compared to final values of 21 and 22. And as you see on line C and line F of both PERS and TERS, while those are red, which would typically indicate some sort of bad situation, these are, in this particular chart, that's good. We're overfunded in these plans. And that goes back to 2018 when we switched over to the employer group waiver program, which we have a slide on later as well. But that was instrumental in reducing the accrued liability by almost $1 billion. Since that time, we've been in an overfunded status. And as you'll see in a later slide where we reflect the FY25 employer contribution rates for both PERS and TERS, the board once again opted to not fund this plan because it is so overfunded. As you can see, we've been looking at line D, which is where we base funding on. We're over 125% on all of these lines from 21 through 23. Now, one thing that we do anticipate and will be discussed about in upcoming ARM board meetings is the changes that are going on with the EGWP program and what that impact will be on funds that we receive through that program and what kind of impact that'll have on the funded status as well as potential future contributions of normal cost back into the healthcare trusts.
And then could you help the committee with you know, when we should be paying more attention to, than less attention on overfunding ratios or underfunding ratios, because you referenced we're somewhere around 130 on the healthcare the last few years. And that that is to a point, I guess, the ARM board is not concerned with it running short. So what's the range on the downside where we should start paying more attention? And
To the chair, Senator Steadman, the ARM board is actually looking at that. That was a topic of discussion where they were looking through the advisors with that report to the ARM board and drafting a policy concerning this so that they too can look at and decide when should we start putting funds back into this healthcare trust.
Okay, and then you'll get back to the committee when that is complete and then we'll have an answer to that question, I guess, whenever they formulate that.
Yes, sir. And as I understand it, you'll probably be having the ARM board representative also presenting to the committee at some time in the future. And they could also talk to that.
Right. We can ask them, and just so we kind of have that as benchmarks when we have potential problems in funding and when we, you know, are well above 100 and where we can start relaxing a little bit.
Yep. To the chair, the ARM board was very cognizant of that and made it a point that they do work on some sort of policy regarding that.
So. Okay. Any other questions on this slide before we go to the next one? Slide 8.
And at this, I'll turn it back over to Director Desai.
For the record, my name is Ajay Desai. Slide 8 shows the funded ratio in a chart format, as you saw the number in the previous slides. These are specific to the PERS system. As you can see, the last very last two bars that shows 2023, the blue line shows about 67% funded for PERS and for the pension plan under PERS, and about 129.6% for the health trust. And the chart kind of shows the historical ups and downs from 2006. The next slide, number 9, shows very similar.
We'll stop there. We've got questions on slide number 8.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the health care, we see dramatic changes in 2014, and the overfunding continued to 2023. These are dollars that are taking out of the individual's paychecks and matched. Why didn't we see an adjustment back then over almost a decade by the ARM board?
Through the chair to
wants to handle Senator, that hot potato.
Sorry, I was taking a little mental break there. So through the chair to Senator Hoffman. So the contributions that are deducted from an employee's paycheck on the defined benefit side, the 6.75% or the minor, you know, for a police officer, firefighter, they pay a little bit more. Those go into the pension trust. The health contributions for the PERS and TERS defined benefit healthcare trust, those are all employer contributions only. So there's no impact to the membership on the health side. So as we see those increases coming in, that's where the ARM board took that action a few years back, where they reduced the contribution into the healthcare trust. And we do have additional slides that deal with some of the funding discussions that we've had on healthcare trusts. But again, in this particular case, there's no impact on the employee contribution. This is all related to the employer, and then that also ties into funding the healthcare and pension trusts on the employer side.
Senator Hoffman.
All that is good and well, but even though it's the employer, it's the state of Alaska. And I'll wait for later slides, but it wouldn't seem that some adjustment would have been made And now we have overfunding of $2 billion when the state of Alaska is in financial straits. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, I think later slides you're going to put dollars on these. Is that correct?
On the bottom.
And we'll wait for
we have a dollar
slides. Yeah, we'll wait for those slides.
We can follow up with the additional information.
Well, I didn't. Can you restate that?
I don't believe that we have a slide that shows a dollar value, but we can follow up with the additional information.
That's fine. We can we'll follow up with that. But and then try to explain to the committee. Here we see, you know, we're struggling back in 06. They're both underfunded, healthcare and pensions. And then as time goes on, we have fixed the underfunding in healthcare, and we need to kind of figure out what's going on with the pension side. Why isn't it following? Because in retrospect, when we go back and we look at 06 and 05, we were working on the liability exposure there and redoing our pension plan. We had we missed the estimate of when we were going to get the unfunded liability paid off by a couple of decades. So we need to touch on that, why this issue doesn't go away.
Through the chair, just a comment regarding the healthcare. So one of the big levers that we had within the healthcare program was that switch over to the employer group waiver plan. And as I mentioned before, that was a reduction of the liability by approximately $1 billion.
Could you speak a little louder? I missed part of that.
Okay.
We want to make sure we hear the positive stuff. We got lots of negative stuff to talk about.
All right. So in regards to the healthcare trust, we had a big lever to use to assist in the funded status of that plan, and that was the employer group waiver plan. And that was the one that saved us approximately $1 billion in liability. And then we've, through different health initiatives that have gone through, picked out the low-hanging fruit and done some of those other things. I don't have anything specific, but those are items that we've talked about previously that assist in keeping costs down and improving the liability cost that, you know, lower costs equals a lower liability for us. So we did have that. On the healthcare side, we don't have those kinds of levers to adjust because of the we don't have those levers available on the pension side. And so the only way we can really get through that is through a consistent funding pattern and funding levels that are requested through the ARM board based on the actuarial work. So we don't have the same lever types on pension that we do on health.
Okay. Next slide, please.
Next slide, number 9, which shows a very similar chart for teachers' retirement system for pension and healthcare. As you can see, for 2023, the green bar shows about around 76.8%, and the orange one at 135.5% for the healthcare funded ratio. Moving on to slide number 10. This one is information only. It shows the funded ratio as a combined for PERS and TERS for pension and health together. So the blue line, as you can see, it is combined for pension and health together. And that would be for 2023 at 85.5%. And for teachers' retirement system, it would be 91.2% for both system together.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Director, which is the first year that we started skipping the normal cost contributions for healthcare on this chart?
I believe that was 2021.
Yeah. Okay, stop for a second. Let's define what normal cost is so those at home could follow us along. And then after we define that, we can talk about the answer to the question. So Because sometimes we talk in language that very few people are around on a daily basis.
Yes, sir. So through the chair to Senator Keel, normal cost is the cost to fund the benefits of the membership in that year. And the way that the fund is, the way that we fund is through a payroll rate. So the actuaries will determine what does it cost to fund the pensions for all eligible membership during that year, and then they convert it into a percentage. So that would be the normal cost or 1 year's cost of benefits accrued, earned.
And then just add to that, how do you get a liability and how do you get a surplus? If the normal cost in a perfect world would always be normal. Okay. But we're not in a normal world.
Well, in the perfect world, like you said, if we lived in a perfect world and all the actuarial assumptions that we have, which are over 30, are met, and the actuary determines a normal cost to be paid during a year, and we hit all the payroll and all the, again, the assumptions with an evaluation report, we fund everything accordingly, we earn what we need to earn, we're at 100%. We've got enough. It's when we start deviating from those assumptions, and let's use rate of return as the basic one. If we hit 7.25, we're good. We're at 100%. If we hit over that, we can get in an overfunded status. Once we earn less than that, that's when we get into this unfunded liability case. And that's just one of the assumptions, and that's a major assumption. But again, we have over 30. But that's where we would get to that case, if that helps.
And then your question, Senator Keel, could you repeat the question, please, and then they can answer it.
Well, thanks, Mr. Chairman. So the question was about what was the first year that we did not make a normal cost contribution for the healthcare side. We didn't pre-fund a year's worth of healthcare benefits that were accrued. And I think you said 21?
It was 22. Through the chair to Senator Keel, I believe it was 22 when the board adopted a zero normal cost rate to go to the healthcare trust.
Follow up?
Yes.
Thanks. So I appreciated the conversation earlier that the board is thinking about what funded ratio will need to be at in healthcare to restart our pre-funding. But I guess the history is a little concerning to me because these were built as blended plans where the healthcare and the pension were in the same trust. And so if one of them had a great cost savings, it helped both of them. And if memory serves, it was 2008 or 9 when they were still a blended plan that we passed a statute, the legislature at the time passed a statute requiring that we never skip a normal cost contribution. So can you talk about, we were forced to split the trusts, right? That wasn't a choice anybody made. Can you talk about where these lines would be if we instead of skipping the pre-funding on healthcare, we'd applied it to the other trust?
So let's just, there's a couple questions there. So just for clarity, let's talk about the combination, why they were, you know, combined or separated or what have you, the history of that, and then go on into trying to answer the question is. We'll have just a brief Eddie's. Brief Eddie. We'll come back on the record. I think the Senator Keel's historic question on the two trusts being separate today and combined in the past. We're going to have the department get back to us so you have a clear understanding of that, because I think it is important. It's a very important issue. And it's also, I think, equally important that when we look at the funding of both the healthcare and the pension, the challenge is in the pension side, that we, as we move on and try to get everything fully funded, we're concentrating on that area of the deficit, of the debt. Does that sound reasonable there, Senator Keel?
Sure. Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I just think it's worth a look at all the choices we're making and how we're putting the entire package together.
And also the historical decisions.
Yes.
And how they worked out in the over time.
Okay. So through the chair to Senator Keel regarding the normal cost contribution to the healthcare trust. So you're correct. There is statutory language that said they would adopt a rate that's normal cost, but there's also language within the ARM board statutes that appear to be a slight conflict. Within the ARM board statutes, it says an acceptable rate. And so the board looked at that and determined that, the PERS and TERS rates set a normal cost rate. They didn't believe, and I'm not speaking for the ARM board, but based on the adoption that they had, it did not seem acceptable to continue funding a plan that was overfunded. So we have a slide a little bit later that shows some of the projected funding statuses of the healthcare trust if we continue not funding it, and you'll see that it continues to stay over at 100%. But again, we will be looking at that due to the changes of the AGWIP plan that are coming up.
And the AGWIP, is that like...
Sorry.
Cooking thing, you're whipping up eggs, or what is
the
that?
Acronym, yes, through the chair. AGWIP is the Employer Group Waiver Program, which is a federal program. AGWIP is just the acronym that we use, and I apologize for continuing to beat that one to death.
Okay, so we'll get some clarity on this, Senator Keel, as we go forward, and I think the committee will be very interested in the policy that comes out of the ARM board and when they want to start increasing the contributions again to healthcare, because it's positive that we've got one in the black. We want to keep it in the black. We'll go on to slide 10, I guess.
Yeah, we were on slide 10. No further question. I can move on to the slide number 11. The slide number 11, the intent of this slide to show the correlation between the rate of return and the funded ratio. How does it impact one versus other? And if you can see it historically, under the PERS, starting with 2001, just before I begin, for 2001 in specific, we all know that there was an other major issue back in before the end of the millennial was with the Mercer, I believe, that we reduced the employer contributions at that time, and the numbers was provided by the actuary was not necessarily accurate, and that was the major factor of the underfunding started back in 2001, 2002. But just to kind of continue following the chart, whatever you see, the red numbers, which are the negative returns, in 2008 and 2009, in the actual funded ratio column, as you can see, it drops from, for 2008, the funded ratio was 69.5% for PERS. That dropped to 61.8%. And subsequent year, we had a negative year with 20.53%, and that resulted even further in 2010 funded ratio to 52.8. And that kind of shows the pattern here. In 2006, again, there was a negative 0.36%, and you can see the funded ratio from 2016 to 17 dropped a little bit down. And very similar situation just recently in 2022 when we have dropped below 0%, which is negative 4%, that number dropped from 87.7 to 85.5. It just shows the correlation of the return, how it impacts the market rate. If, as Mr. Worley indicated earlier, in a perfect world, if we were to continue to meet the assumed rate, there will be no underfunding at all. However, we will see in further, well, actually in the same slide, as you can see at the bottom line, the 30 years average rate of return is 7.55, which is a little bit higher for PERS than it is currently set at 7.25. And for TERS, it's a 7.6. So even though there's a 30 years average returns are looking pretty spot on based on the long-term rate that is set today, when market fluctuates and brings the negative returns or below the assumed rate of return, it will impact the funding ratio. It doesn't mean that the plan is not capable of making pension payments for the retirees today, because this is for the long term. It just shows the historical trend and also kind of allows us to see the future, that what is the impact of the returns that is a major player for the funding.
Okay, could you help me a little bit? I understand there's a litany of issues that we faced back at the turn of the century. There was the error from the actuary. There was misestimates on healthcare, life expectancy tables, rates of return. There's a litany of issues where we had problems with. We had three boards instead of one board. We had a lot of problems with that old plan. But that was solidified and corrected, and we've been on the march since then to take care of this unfunded liability. So why are we not eliminating this unfunded liability when we should have more accurate actuarial work done? In other words, we didn't have this another mistake, and we have actuaries checking actuaries. So help me understand why we keep not eliminating this debt.
You want to?
Okay.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Kathy Lee with the Division of Retirement and Benefits. To the Chair, Senator Stedman, there's two things that can't really be controlled when we're valuing the plans, and that is the market experience and the length of time we're paying benefits. And one of the things with the defined benefit plan, when they were originally crafted, I think 1898 was the first United States plan. The retirement date was age 65, but the mortality date was somewhere in the 50s. So we weren't paying people benefits for very long. So as we go through time and we have better medical care and better nutrition, we have retirees living longer. When I came to the division, there was nobody over 100 years old receiving benefits. When I left the division 3 years ago, there were 30. So as our population ages and we're paying benefits for longer and longer, that's a hard thing to estimate, is when people are going to die. So between the length of time that we're paying benefits as well as the volatility of the markets, the actuaries can only do their best in assuming what's going to happen. And when, as CFO Worley explained, when those assumptions are not met in any way, then we find ourselves in an underfunded position.
Mm-hmm. Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I understand the beneficiaries are living longer, but the beneficiaries also are benefits of this as well. Can a beneficiary of the Tier 1, Tier 2 give their benefit to a trust?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, the member can only leave their pension to a spouse, or the spouse can waive that and give it to an incapacitated child, but they can't leave it to a trust. If there is no spouse, no incapacitated child, all benefits cease with the member's death.
As I recall, we addressed that when we redid the pension plan years ago. There was concern that you could give it to your spouse, and then something happens to you, and then your new spouse gets a new spouse, and it can go on for quite some time. And as just as a point, the other day I noticed in the newspaper the last surviving Civil War beneficiary died. I think a couple of years ago we were shocked at the table that we had Civil War beneficiaries still receiving payments on the Civil War little pension. So I just thought I'd mention that because we were all aghast a couple of years ago when we learned that when we were dealing with the subject. But Senator Keel.
Mr. Chairman, the good news is a couple of years ago we passed a bill ending child marriage, which is what that bride had been.
Yeah, there was an issue there. Do we have any other questions? And I think one of the challenges we have here, and I know we've expressed this in the past, and this is kind of to the ARM board, I think, too. We were concerned years ago that 8.25 was too high, and then they finally moved it to 8, and we were concerned about that. So I think the estimated rate of return targets are a little closer, a little better than before, even though our contribution increases. And we'll touch on some of that stuff, how they're inversely related.
And to the chair, if I could make one additional comment and add on to what Chief Pension Officer Lee said. We also recently had a Supreme Court case that settled a couple of years ago that was called the Metcalf case. And previously, statutes had cut off June 30th, 2010, where if you were a prior defined benefit member, you didn't get back into the system then. If you came back after that date and had refunded your defined benefit balance, you'd have to come in as a defined contribution member, and that was determined to be a diminishment. Correct? Diminishment? Okay, so diminishment. So with that particular court case, what happened was now folks that were in the defined contribution plan, they could go back to their prior defined benefit tier. So we've had some increase in liability. We haven't been able to separately identify that, but we have had over 100 people that were prior defined contribution members that have purchased their time as a defined benefit member as well as their time as a defined contribution member because it became eligible for a defined benefit. So that there is some impact of that.
And then before we go to Senator Hoffman's question, what are you talking about when you're about a diminishment of benefits and what controls that?
Is that something you can handle?
Kathy Lee, Chief Pension Officer, Division of Retirement and Benefit, to the chair. Senator Stedman, retirement benefits are guaranteed in the Alaska Constitution. And so the benefits that are in effect when an employee comes to work are the benefits they're entitled to upon retirement. And we've had several court cases over the years regarding diminishment of benefits, meaning that later laws come along and change the benefits. And if they are applied to the person who had employed before those new statutes become effective and they diminish that person's benefit, then we are not allowed to use that statute when calculating retirement benefits or eligibility for that person. So in this case, the PERS statutes stated that if you terminate employment, withdraw all your contributions, you are a former member of the plan. And that was interpreted as all your rights were terminated at that point. And so when you came back into employment, you started new. According to the court, however, because at the time of employment, there was no statute specifically dealing with tier, the expectation for most of these people was if they came back into employment, they would come back into a defined benefit plan because there was no DC plan at the time they terminated. So the court recognized those rights and said that placing them in a defined contribution plan diminished the benefits they were entitled to from their first hire date.
So thank you, because it's an important issue for the public to understand the diminishment of benefits. Everybody here at the table works around that quite often in the Constitution, so it's well worth repeating. And I think years ago, the department brought forward an analysis showing the people that came back into the tier, you know, bought back their old service and stuff and went out, and some of us were shocked. Some of them were in on Friday and out on Monday. But that's the law of the land. Some of us thought when we saw that data sheet, it was years that it worked or months or whatever. We had no idea it was days. But we will honor the court's rulings, and it's the law of the land, so that's the way it is. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of questions. First, in Alaska, I think we probably have some of the highest rates of common law marriages, and I understand that those are not recognized with the retirement system. My question, if you could do some research, if you don't know it, do other states recognize those common law marriages? And the second one was, there was a court case, I believe, with the regarding the LGBT community, and can you refresh my memory of how, as it relates to benefits, what was that decision? If you don't have the answer, you can check on that for me.
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, I can give you an overview answer now, but we would need to give you a more detailed answer later. Yes, there are other states that recognize common law marriage. Alaska is not one of them. And so the way the statutes read, you have to be legally married in order to name a common law spouse as a beneficiary to receive your lifetime retirement benefit in the event of your death. As far as the LGBT group goes, there was a court case, and if the LGBT couple could establish that they held assets in common and that they were in a long-term relationship, that we could recognize that as a way for them to name their partner as a surviving spouse. When Alaska legalized LGBT marriages, then that's the law we use right now because it's a legal marriage.
So the question that I have, I guess, is that when that lawsuit originally happened, the state did not recognize them. So it would seem to me that if we lost that case and there was no real marriage certificate between the LGBT community, between the spouses, why wouldn't we as a precedent look at that and recognize common law marriages? Because it would seem that they both fall in a similar category.
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, they're very different arrangements. And the court case for the LGBT group did not include any comments about common law marriage.
I understand that.
So we implemented the court case as it stood and maintained the rest of the law regarding Alaska not recognizing a common law marriage. There was not an issue brought forward in the courts regarding common law marriage.
So the question that I have is that was the LGBT decision made prior, the court case made prior to the state of Alaska recognizing those marriages?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, yes, it was.
And that's the case that I'm bringing forward. It seems as though that you say they're not similar, but in my view, they are similar. In fact, probably more so for people that are in a relationship for 10, 15, 20 years, recognized as common law marriages. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And you guys can get back to the committee with more detail on that answer, too, for the good stuff. Senator Merrick.
Thank you, Chair Stedman. Ms. Lee, I appreciate your answers today. I just want to confirm what you said, that the courts have ruled that being forced to move to a defined contribution plan when you were previously in a defined benefit plan is considered a diminishment in benefits.
Through the chair, Senator Merrick, that's my understanding of the court ruling.
Thank you.
I would say in particular if you're tier one. So we have any other questions before we go to slide 12? Okay, we're on slide 12.
Moving right along.
Moving right along, we might run long, whatever. We'll just keep the pace up and we'll see how we are in an hour.
Moving on to slide number 12. This slide shows unfunded actuarial liability for PERS specifically. And the blue colors kind of is for the pension. And orange is for the healthcare. As you can see, the pension is upwards above zero. And pensions is below zero because it's overfunded. Very similar to slide number 13.
Wait, just on slide number 12, how come, help me with 2013, we have an unfunded liability, $5.4 billion, and today it's $5.5 billion, and we spent a lot of money trying to deal with that. Help me understand why we're not gaining on that, and you address that a little bit.
Go to David.
Yeah.
I would like to invite David Kirshner from Buck to explain the history of the unfunded actuarial liability and to answer your question. David?
Okay, I will. We'll go to.
Mike, can you hear me?
Yes, Mr. Kirshner, can you help us? And then if you happen to know how much we paid over that time frame, would be nice too. But go ahead and address 06 to 13 and 13 to 23, please.
Okay, well, I don't have offhand at my fingertips the amount that the state has contributed, but we do have that information available that we can follow up with. But from, you have to keep in mind, as we just looked at on slide 11, the actuarial assumed earnings assumption, the assumed earnings on the trust has been decreasing over time. So we have to, when we look at the unfunded liability, we have to keep in mind that over time, our actuarial assumptions used to measure the liabilities have become more conservative, which means our liabilities have gone up, which would drive the unfunded liability to go up. So if you're looking, for example, at 2013 to 2013, we were using an 8% assumption on earnings, and now we're using a 7.25, and dropping that 75 basis points would increase the liabilities probably in the 9%, roughly 9% range, so it can have a pretty significant impact. The other thing to keep in mind, and this has particularly affected the pension unfunded liabilities in the last couple of years, because the last few years of high inflation, the CPI increases directly affect the post-retirement pension adjustments, the PRPAs. They're paid to all PERS and TERS retirees. They get a percentage of the CPI increase, and we're currently assuming that CPI increase is 2.5%. And every year, particularly the last 3 years, we've had significant losses are significantly higher than expected liabilities because the actual CPI increases have been much higher. So you have to keep in mind when you're looking at a chart, a historical chart like this, you've got a lot of moving parts that can factor into the changes from, looking over from 1 year to the next.
Okay, and then help me with a little bit, because I understand we went from 8.25 probably back in 06 down to 8%. looking forward in the financial markets. And now we're using 7.25. And it's pretty clear that when you, everything else being constant, when you change the that rate and lower it, your liability increases, your debt increases. So why wouldn't your, the question is, and why don't you have a corresponding increase in contributions to eliminate this debt?
Through the chair, we do have an increase. So when we lower that assumed interest rate from, yeah, as you mentioned, 8.25, now we're at 7.25, that increases our contribution rate. We also have, as Kevin Worley mentioned, we have dozens of assumptions related to future patterns of retirement and life expectancies and salary increases. So it's not just the investment return of a assumption, although that's a key one. But we do have when our unfunded liability increases, we do increase the contribution rate, but we don't make those changes immediately because we're funding under the statutes, we're funding the unfunded liability over a 25-year period. So in a given year, when we have a loss due to, or an increase in the unfunded liability due to lower investment earnings than we assumed, or we change to more conservative assumptions, or we have higher inflation, those losses are then funded over a 25-year period. They're not funded immediately in the short term. So that's another reason why, is think of it like a cruise ship. When you change directions of the cruise ship, it's a slight change. You don't have a dramatic change to get to your ultimate goal. You just have to tweak your direction a little bit.
Okay, and then just, again, help me a little bit more. It was mentioned we had a problem with a previous actuary, and that was a portion of the need to rewrite our structure, our retirement system, a couple of decades ago almost now. But back then, the pension was 1.7, according to this chart, and I assume the 1.7 in 2006 billion, 1.763, was accurately calculated at the time, because that would have been after the actuarial issue. And now we're at 5.5. So, and we're at 5.4 in 13, and 10 years later, we're at 5.5. So can you help me with why that's happened? You mentioned that we've changed the rate or target rate from 8.25 over that time frame to 7.25. But what else is going on in that, Ralph, in that stream where we're not down in the $2 billion range or less?
Well, through the chair, several things, off the top of my head, a couple of other things that have had a big impact. I think this was changed in 2014, I believe. The amortization method of the unfunded liability was changed from what's called a level dollar amortization to level percentage of pay. And if I can try and give an example, if you have a home mortgage where you have a level dollar amortization, you're basically paying the same dollar amount to fund that mortgage. Under a level percentage of pay, you would basically start out lower, and then you would increase, you'd have an index series of payments pay off your mortgage. So it's the same amount of mortgage that you're paying off, you just have a different pattern. With that, going to a level percentage of pay ends up deferring some of the funding into the future years rather than the earlier years. So if you compare level dollar versus level percentage of pay, amortizing or funding on level dollar, you have higher amounts in the shorter term, in the first 5 or 10 years, and then the level percentage of pay. So there's a lot of moving parts in here that make it hard to answer the question completely, but we can certainly provide Division of Retirement Benefits with some of the historical reasons for how things have changed between 2006 and 2014. We're actually providing some of that information to the ARM board at the upcoming meeting in March, but that's really from 2018 going forward, or from 2014 going forward. So we'd have to dig into some historical valuation reports to provide some of the older history going back to 2006, but we can certainly do that and provide the Division of Retirement Benefits with some of those reasons, and they can provide that to the committee.
That would be helpful, and let's not forget, I think we did an equity infusion into this a few years ago, an additional $2 billion over the normal contribution, and the chunk went to TERS and PERS, and so this doesn't show our cash flow in, and it would be nice to actually have a chart similar to this where we can watch our liability and then the cash flow that the state is paying in against the debt. So we can keep track of that. It gets a significant amount of money over time. And I guess the point I'm trying to bring out here is we've had a problem with an actuary in the past, and if that was the only problem, none of this other stuff would have been going on. We would have been able to have this paid off. There's other things going on under here moving its value other than the error that the previous actuary made almost two decades ago. So it's a significant amount of dollars here. So, and again, this is just not trying to, throw any shade on the current actuary or the department or anything else. It's just the mechanics of 30-some variables that we've got to be right on, and then we need the appropriation to retire the debt. It's not an easy task, or wouldn't be here today. Any other questions on this slide before we go to the next one? Slide 13, please.
Slide 13, similar information for the unfunded actuarial liability shows for teachers' retirement system. Just to make it a point on slide 12 and slide 13, as you mentioned earlier, that back in 2015, the infusion of nearly $3 billion, $2 billion under TERS and $1 billion under PERS did make a significant difference. As you can see, the green bar is rising all the way up to 13 and dropped after 14 and then 15, and it's kind of stabilized bit. So that did really help to bring the unfunded liability dramatically down from 3.1 to 1.6 from 14 to 15. And those will show in the next slide, a few slides in the numbers as well.
So are you done with this one?
Yes, sir.
Okay, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you. You mentioned that in 14 and 15, the legislature used the lever of appropriation to appropriate $3 billion. And Mr. Worley said that the ARM board doesn't have those levers to make the adjustments regarding health care costs. But as appropriators, I'm wondering if the legislature has levers to address it monetarily as we did back in 14 and 15. And maybe you can't answer that, but I think that's a question that we should ask our legal department if we have the levers. We use those levers in the past to effectuate the rates that the ARM board used to adjust those rates. The ARM board does not have that flexibility, but as appropriators, we may have that flexibility. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We can ask that, but let me rephrase that just to see. So I think what you're asking, if we have zero normal cost for health care because we're overfunded, we basically don't fund it cash-wise, and we take all of the cash that would have gone to health care and pension, and we direct it to the pensions from the table here. In other words, we don't lower our payment, but is that what you're asking?
I don't think we can direct it toward the retirement end, but we can have a lesser amount being appropriated for health care because we are the appropriators. The ARM board can't do that because They don't have that lever available to them, but we as appropriators have that lever, and we utilize that lever in 14 and 15.
We can explore that to see the separation if we can do things like that. My understanding is we could do additional appropriations to the pension plan if we so choose as appropriators, or less. Yeah. So we'll clarify that for all the members when we have the discussion. I'm not saying we have any extra cash laying around in billions, don't let people get excited, but we need to know all of the tools that we have available to us. Going to slide 14.
Moving on to slide 14. This slide shows the combined unfunded actuarial liability chart. This is information only, as it's a system level percentage, which shows the blue are PERS and green colors TERS. As of 2023, you can see the bar is significantly low compared to the number before 2015, after the infusion of that $3 billion.
If I can just make a suggestion, I think we need to be cautious with the combined slides, because a lot of folks in the building may not recognize the issue of the two trusts.
That is correct, sir.
So makes it hard sometimes in the building to clarify things when they get something set in their mind that's inaccurate.
Moving on to slide number 15. This slide shows the additional state contributions as a history. As of 2024, so far, the state has infused about $8.4 billion dollars towards the unfunded liability. And this additional contribution comes in lieu of the total employer contributions, where employer contributions are capped for PERS at 22%, and for TERS, it is capped at 12.56%. So when actuarial rate for the specific year requires a higher contributions, that gap is filled by the state as additional state contributions. And this history shows as of 2024, the number is below at 8.355.
Yeah, and additionally, keeping in mind that we had Senate Bill 55 that passed a couple of years back that required the state to pay the full actuarial rate. So that contributed to the decrease between 22 and 23. Because the state was taken out of that additional state contribution calculation. And so the additional state contribution for over 22% on PERS only applies to employers that are not the state.
So help me with this clarification a little bit. So like on PERS, we're dealing with $3.5 billion in these appropriations, and you have the budget cited, budget years, and so on and so forth. Is there any other appropriations that went to the unfunded liability? So the question, I guess another way of putting the question, what's the total additional payments that we've made for the pension, both PERS and TERS, but separate, but on the pension side, because that's the two we're concerned about, since the 2006 over the normal cost, and normal cost being the 12.46 for TERS, I guess it is, and then whatever the normal cost is for PERS.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, we'd have to get back to you on the split out between pension and healthcare. It's only been the last few years that it was directed specifically to pension, other than the $1 billion that went directly to the pension trust, and the majority of that $2 billion went to the TERS pension trust. But
yeah,
the rest of it, we'd have to get back to you on that.
Okay, that's fine. The point of the question is cash flow. Just think of it as cash flow. Cash flow and the unfunded liability. Because if that wasn't going to the unfunded liability, that cash flow could have been redirected to whatever. Savings, dividends, capital budgets, whatever we decided to spend it on. But it'd be nice to know a clear, what we've had since 2006. And then there's the municipal portion, but we've got that, as you mentioned, capped at 22%. We pick up everything north of that. And just for those watching at home, just briefly on that subject, we had capped that. We pulled the entire payroll at the and capped it at 22% to keep the communities solvent. And the state took the risk. And the first one, I think that would have probably went broke, would have been Fairbanks, because I think their payroll would have been their unfunded liability would have been 180% of their payroll, followed by a litany of other communities around the state. And rather than have years of litigation, we just took that dead on. But we need to keep track of that, you know, impact on the cash flow. So, and bifurcate that out. So that's kind of just a brief synopsis of why that is at 22%. Large enough to get the municipal's attention and other members, non-state members' attention, but not enough to bankrupt them. And that was a political number set by and led by, I think, this finance committee, actually. So, yeah, so I guess in respect, you'll help us with the cash flow numbers, and that'd be good. Okay. Go on to 16, please.
Moving on to slide number 16, this one shows the additional state contributions projected based on the draft actuarial valuation report as of June of 2023. So from 2025 through 2039, where we assume that the plans would be fully funded, the additional projected state contribution would be at approximately about $4.4 billion, combining both for centers.
Okay, I hate to ask this, but if we went back to 2010 and you answered the same question, it'd be interesting to see what that would be. The complexity of the issue we're facing, it seems like we always have a moving target. There's inflation, market reductions, people living longer. There's things moving this goalpost out in front of us, and we keep chasing it. We want to catch it eventually before we die of old age. So if you could help me with that. The ARM board used to come in, Callan would come in and give us their projections, their 8.25 projections, and we'd make them do that every year, put it on a chart, and show us where we were supposed to be when we were arguing over that 8.25% rate being too high, and we could never catch it. And I know they didn't like producing that chart, but it made the point that when we had a set time, whatever year it was, and we shot it out at 8.25%, and then we backed it, you know, 3 years go by, we go back and look at where we're supposed to be, we could never catch the line. And every year we had another line. And I think we've, you know, rectified that now, but we still, it is a concern. So if you can help us with that, that would be great.
Next slide, number 17, Mr. Worley.
On slides, excuse me, on Kevin Worley, Chief Financial Officer, Division of Retirement and Benefits. On slide 17 are the board adopted contribution rates for PERS and for TERS for FY25. The ARM board did adopt these at the September meeting of 2023. Within this computation, on the prior slide for FY25 were the additional state contributions that are currently in the operating bill. So if we look back, if I could just briefly online, the first line for fiscal year 2025, the 59.1 and the $123.4 million, that is in the current legislation for the operating bill for FY25. So in discussion with the board adopted rates, typically what Buck will do is the calculation of the normal and past service cost rates for the defined benefit plans for both PERS and TERS, as well as computing what the contributions would be for the defined contribution plan and then limit those based on statutory rates for PERS of 22% for all employers except for the state of Alaska, and then for all the school districts and participating TERS employers at the 12.56 rate. Excuse me. So if we look at the column heading called preliminary, you'll see that on the third line down for DB health plan normal cost, calculations were 1.94 for PERS and 2.1 for TERS, which resulted in contributions of $47.8 million and roughly $16.2 million of those capped rates that would have been cash flowed into the healthcare trust. The board, looking at the fact that both the PERS and TERS healthcare trusts were overfunded, and as we'll see in the later slide, will continue to be overfunded, adopted a rate where 0% would be contributed to the healthcare trust for PERS and TERS. So as you see in the adopted column, which is the third column heading over for each of those tables, you'll see that those were substituted by a 0%. So that resulted in a reduction to the additional state contributions that would go into PERS and TERS, because that money is now being shifted and not directly directed by the ARM board, but because of the way the statute reads under the 22%. That money that would have previously gone to the healthcare trust, in essence, goes to the past service costs of the pension trust, because none is going to the healthcare trust, and employers are paying those capped rates of 22 and 12.56%. So ultimately, that ended up in a savings of about $63, $64 million for the additional state contributions.
Does that help, Senator Hoffman, in your earlier question as far as the redirecting of cash flow?
Well, that's what I was actually looking at. But the question that I have, if we are the appropriators, can we appropriate a negative amount because it's overfunded? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We'll look into that. So let's boil it down and make it simpler. Mm-hmm. Me to understand.
Sure.
I've got to pay for the current employees, everything they accrued in 1 year, the normal cost, normal service cost. And then I have another appropriation for anything that's due on the unfunded liability. Two buckets. What's the size of each bucket? And that should equal how much is going to the retirement system, the pension. Can you give us a ballpark? And because it's a magnitude of what we're dealing with that catches our attention sometimes. And you could get back to us, or if you want to give us a ballpark and get back to us on the, or however you want to answer it, it's fine with me.
I'd appreciate that, sir.
Okay. That would be good, so the department can get back on that. It is what it is, by the way. I'm not saying it's good or bad. It's the cost of the pension, and we have to cash flow it. And another comment that we haven't made for those watching at home, there is no concern of anybody not getting a pension check at all whatsoever. We have ample funds available for many, many, many years. And if you could touch on that in your presentation sometime, because on occasion, some people watch our meetings and they think that we don't have the resources to pay the retirement system, and that is not the case at all. Just trying to save my phone ringer from getting all out.
Understood.
We'll go ahead and continue.
Any other questions on 17? So moving on to slide 18, here's where we look at the healthcare funded levels in terms of, had we made that normal cost contribution, that normal cost that we saw in the previous slide under the preliminary, or if the board adopted a zero contribution rate for the normal cost for health. So if you look at PERS, we're starting off under the with normal cost contributed, the first column. We go from a 129.6 in fiscal year 24 of what we're currently in. And assuming all the assumptions stay the same between now and 2039, you'll see that that increases by 50 points to almost 180%. And you'll see similar with the, if the normal cost is contributed on the TERS healthcare trust, we go from a 135 up to almost 197%. And what the ARM board has chosen to do over the last few years is not make that normal cost contribution or adopting a zero rate going into the healthcare trust. And you'll see we start off at that 129.6, and that increase, obviously, because cash flow in from the employer side, nothing is going into the healthcare trust. It's just having investment earnings at this point, increases up to 170.9, so a 9% less. And we see similar with the TERS healthcare trust. And again, that's if we're hitting the assumptions, we're earning the rates of return. That's what that difference would be. We'd still be, without contributing to the healthcare trust, just relying on investment earnings and the assumptions on the healthcare trust payments for healthcare benefits, we're still overfunded. Now, again, we are looking at the impact of changes that were made through the employer group waiver program or that EGWP program, and what that impact is going to be. And that's a topic of discussion that'll be coming up at the March meeting and probably in the June meeting as well. But it is a topic that Buck, our consulting actuary, will be discussing with the board.
Any other questions on this one? Senator Hoffman.
You know, I think that magnifies the question that I have, is that the legislature contributed in the past to get us where we are at 129.6 in the market, you know, for is going to approach between 180 to 190% liquidity or funding. So the question is, can we appropriate, as appropriators, can we appropriate a negative number to bring that down to a level that is in the 140 to 150% as appropriators? That's the question that I have, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll work on answering that and see what tools we have available. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess maybe the alternate perspective, when we look back at the old charts, healthcare has been maybe, predicting healthcare has been one of the most volatile things. I will appreciate the ARM board's work on a trigger to start contributing again toward normal cost. I think, you know, the federal program giveth and the federal program taketh away to cost experience sometimes. And I'm sure glad it's been giveth-ing, but I think it's worth having a trigger policy in place from the board to bring to the legislature. One thing I think this past presentation has talked about is if you get behind, it's tough to dig out. And so there ought to be a place at which we contemplate where we contribute again, because the volatility in predicting healthcare has been probably the biggest or the most difficult thing in this process.
Well, I think that's a good idea, and we've requested that policy, you know, when they formulate it to come back to the committee. But and we'll have that discussion on how much overfunding is comfortable. But clearly, this is a huge success story, because back when we redid the retirement plan, the healthcare was a huge concern, and it had a bigger liability than the pension side. Now that's reversed. So this is a success, and we shouldn't, you know, we don't want to diminish it. We just have other hungry little mouths to feed here at the table that take cash. So we don't want to go back to have it underfunded in any way. But it is a success, and I'd like to thank the staff, retirement and benefits, for all the years of hard work to get us to the point we're at today here. It wasn't an easy task. It started 17 some years ago. And it is appreciated that we can now have a discussion of having too much in it. So we'll just don't want that to be missed at the from the public how big of a success this has been. Very, very successful.
Yeah, if we, through the chair, if we want to give real credit, you know, Emily Ricci was in that position at the time, as well as Michelle Machad. So both those folks were very instrumental in leading that program and had good staff and good support from the division to make that happen, as well as the legislature and the burn board.
Yeah. Thanks.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Hoffman.
I might point out that there are four members of the Finance Committee that have been around, that are still at this table that were around 17 years ago.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, I think you're one of them.
Here for 30.
30 years. Yes, there are four of us. So we have a lot of history on this subject, and it's nice to have big problems solved, even if it takes us a decade to do it. We'll go on to, I guess, 18, if there's any more comments on, I guess, or discussion on 18. We'll go on to 19.
Moving on to page 19. This slide shows the FY fiscal year 2025 contribution rates for defined benefit plans. Under the first column, PERS shows the employee contribution rate for all other employees is at 6.75. Peace officer firefighters are at 7.5. And school district alternate options are paying at 9.6%. If you go down a line further for the employer, rates are currently capped at 22%, but if you were to look at the total rate at the bottom, actuarial rate for the year is at 26.76, out of which 4.76 has been contributed by the state as an additional state contribution. Similarly, on a teacher's retirement system, the employee contribution in the system is going at 8.65%. The employer rates are capped at 12.56%, and total required contribution rate for the fiscal year, which is the last line at 28.59%, the difference, which is a 16.03%, will be paid by as a state additional state contributions that we saw earlier in the slides.
Okay, and I just want to correct the record. I think I misspoke here a while back on the TERS rate at 12, I think I said 12.45 or 12.46, it's 12.56. It's been that way for years.
Moving on to slide number 20. Similarly, this slide shows the FY 2025 contribution rate for defined contribution plans. And employees are paying at 8% under PERS, and employers are paying at 5%. On investment account. The current rate for the FY25 for the healthcare for retiree major medical plan is at 0.83%. Occupational death and disability for all others is at 0.24, and peace officer firefighters are at 0.69. And for the health reimbursement account, HRA, calculated, it is as a flat dollar. What that means is about 3% for all PERS and TERS average annual compensation. So the total payroll, the 3% of the total payroll would be calculated, and that would be used as a flat dollar amount to contribute towards the HRA for each individual. Similarly, on the last column shows the rates for teachers' retirement system. Similar to PERS, employee contributions are at 8%. Employer contributions for teachers' retirement system is at 7% with 2% differential compared to the PERS. For healthcare, a retiree major medical plan is at 0.68, and occupational death and disability for teachers is at 0.08%. Now, one thing to keep in mind here, the very last line, it shows that excess from employers' contributions, which is under PERS, as I mentioned earlier, we receive 22%, and for TERS, we receive about 12.56%. So after all these contributions are paid under the defined contributions plan, any remainder amount out of those 22% or 12.56% respectively goes towards the defined benefit plan unfunded liability.
Any questions on this one? Okay, and then you're going to get back to us on this in dollars, historical dollars.
Yes, sir. Okay. We'll follow up with that one. Thank you.
On to slide 21.
Slide number 21. This one shows the contribution rate history, again in graphical format, showing from 2008 through current. The top section shows for the PERS, and simply the blue line at the bottom is the flat rate of 22% for PERS for employers' contributions. And the orange line that fluctuates at one point, if you see in 2013 and 14, it reached almost like nearly 36%. So the gap between those actuarial rate versus the capped 22% rate, those are the additional state contributions. And you can see that in graphical format that has been paid over the years from 2008 through 2025.
And this is just for the non-state employers?
This is up to 2022 for all state and non-state employers, and after 2022 SB
55,
it is only for the non-state employers. Similar chart shows for the TERS at the bottom. As you can see, the graph significantly fluctuates from where it started in 2008 and what it is today. So in between gaps that you see, those are the additional state contributions. Visually gives you an idea of that $8.4 billion. So moving on to slide number 22. Projected pension benefit recipients. So this is the chart for the benefit recipients, which are the retirees, beneficiaries, and all disabled participants. We are assuming that in 2025, we will be paying about 54,000 people, over 54,000 people in 2025. Among those, nearly 40,000 from PERS and about nearly 14,600 people for TERS. And that numbers of the payers will peak around 2030. We'll be paying at the highest number of retirees in 2030, if we were to count as a total, at 58,000 members, retirees. The breakdown for PERS shows at 42,400 in 2030. And the highest number for TERS in 2031 will be paying at nearly 16,000 retirees. And number will start declining until the last payments are made, if system remains closed. Any questions on slide 22? Moving on to slide number 23. Very similar chart shows in the dollar value that projected pension benefits payments will be paying about $1.7 billion in 2025, and the highest peak will be in 2037 at $2.1 billion. And going forward, the chart declines as the retirees' population declines.
Can you help me with the length of the tail? Because it goes out to 2100. That's the end of the century. How come it goes so long?
Yes, as we speak today, we have about, if you notice on the page number, initial page numbers on a members count, number three, we still have about 11,000 active members under the defined benefit system between PERS and TERS, those who are not retired yet. And we'll continue to assume that when they retire, all these payments, including the current retirees, will continue to receive the payment until the end of the century. And this number kind of changes year to year based on our demographic changes, but approximately we are estimating, according to the Buck actuary, the last person will be receiving the payment by the end of the century, 2100, or maybe a little bit over 2100, one or two.
So can I hold you to that, and we'll meet back up here and have that discussion?
I'll be here.
Well, a very important point to make it here, Senator Stedman, as you mentioned earlier, that we saw many numbers in earlier slides. And I agree with you as you made a comment that the people who are listening at home, that when you see a number of unfunded liability, even when I started back in 2017, the numbers were pretty much significantly high. At unfunded liability was at $8 billion, or nearly $8 or $9 billion. That has significantly come down today, not only with as we go along and additional state contributions are received based on the projected numbers come from the actuary, but at the same time, when we implemented the AgWIP, which is Employer Group Waiver Program, helped us tremendously, dropping the unfunded liability by at least $1 billion in the projections. And in the following slide, I'll show you the numbers, how we are doing on that part. But it is absolutely true that retirees, those who are receiving payment today, or the retirees, participants who are not retired today, do not have to worry about that, will I get my pension until I leave? Yes. Answer is yes, that you will. The fund will be there. And by 2039, at least we are projected to be 100% funded. And that's the message I would like to convey. Moving on to page number 24. This is just a history. When we started this one, an employer group waiver plan is a group Medicare Part D prescription drug plan option, known also as AgWIP, provides a direct subsidy which allows it to be considered when calculating other post-employment benefit, otherwise known as an OPEB liability, under both GASB and FASB accounting schemes. GASB stands for Governmental Accounting Standard Board, and FASB stands for Financial Accounting Standard Boards. The implementation of AgWIP reduced in 6/30/2018 healthcare liability by about $959 million, which resulted in lower projected liabilities, lower projected contribution rates, and lower projected additional state contributions, approximately $711 million for PERS and $248 million for TERS. That was based on the calculation as of 6/30/2018. And the biggest impact of the AgWIP, that it allows, this particular plan allows us to use the future savings to use towards the unfunded liability, OPEB liability. Comparatively, pre-implementation of this program, we used to receive RDS, which is retiree drug subsidy. It works kind of a reverse mode. If I were to give you a little bit example of how the RDS, retiree drug subsidy, works versus the employer group waiver program. The retiree subsidy program would work after we spend the money. We would request and provide all the actuarial data and expenditures to the federal government, and we would receive up to about $20 million approximately. That was the 2017-18 numbers in a range that we would receive. And we could not use those savings in advance for future calculations for the unfunded liabilities. It was based on an ongoing basis. Comparatively, implementation of the AgWIP plan that allowed us to calculate and measure the future savings and use that savings towards the unfunded liability reduction. And that was a major player to reduce the healthcare cost and being today in overfunded status. And as Kevin mentioned earlier, Emily Ritchie, who was a rough diamond back in 2014, and today she's a shining diamond in the state, of course, has been stolen from us by the other department, and continually, subsequently, Betsy Wood, Andrea Moika, and my entire health team that is sitting behind me, Steve Ramos, Teddy, and Brandon, they are the key players been there for the implementation of this plan. So that this plan really helped us a lot, bring a lot of savings. And moving on to the slide number 25. What we predicted that it will bring about $60 million in gross as a saving each year, subtracting $20 million in net that we used to get from the old program, would at least bring $40 million in saving every year. Having said that, 2019, when we implemented, we got a savings of 49.5, which is net of those, I would say, nearly $30 million of the savings. But 2020 forward, if you notice it, the savings were at $58 million. 21 was at 64.4. 2022 at 75.7. And for 2023, estimated savings are at $86.23 million. So those are the significant savings under this program the division was able to implement and bring on a table that allows us to kind of have some benefits through the federal program.
And that's another very successful adjustment or maneuver that was led by the staff. When we did that here at the table and moved along, we were hoping it would stick, in which it did. And so, again, here's another very successful assistance that the department has given to help with this financial challenge we have.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Moving on to slide 26, this is Kevin Morley, Chief Financial Officer, Division of Retirement and Benefits. So tying in with the employer group waiver program, one of the assumptions that we use within the valuation reports is that of healthcare cost trends and what we see as increases from one fiscal year to the next in terms of projecting costs going into the future, so that when we present value those back to get the accrued liability number that we use in a funded ratio. But these are the rates that were recently adopted after the most recent experience study. And the experience study is something that is done every 4 years and reported to the ARM board, at which point we would look at what occurred during that four-year period and what actually happened. So what actually happened versus what was in the assumptions, and see if we need to make any adjustments in those assumptions, which the board would then consult with their actuary and then adopt those or make any modifications to it. So this is what is currently in place for the healthcare.
Any questions on this one? Okay, we'll go on to slide 27.
The slide 27 is the kind of a timeline, a process timeline that shows what it takes for the employers and additional state contribution calculations and determination to start with. So as you can see on the very first, the top layer, we use 2022 valuation data and liabilities, and 2023 actual rate of return and projected for 2024 with 7.25 to calculate FY 2025 employers rate that we saw earlier in the slides. And similarly for the future reference, kind of shows the future years, but it takes about, it's a 4 years, approximately at least minimum 3 years or 4 years of data that goes into the determination of calculating the contribution rates. Just informational slide, and that concludes our presentation. Do you have any questions?
The slide you were looking for all morning, I'm sure.
No, we were looking for this one, actually. So if you have any questions, please contact Amanda Pelafon or Wesley Isaacs for questions if there's anything after our meeting.
Okay. Yeah, we have a couple here. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you look at slide 24, I guess I'm not understanding how you have $1 billion savings if you opt for another drug option plan. In the first bullet point, it talks about Part D Medicare. How were you able to, what's the mechanics, or how were you able to go in and save almost $1 billion by offering this additional option, where I would think if you had an additional option, it would cost you money.
Chair. Senator Olson, I will primarily answer the question, and I will bring David in the picture to answer it further. As I explained to you earlier, that the previous program that we had in place, which is a retiree drug subsidy program, that's been there in place for many, many years. And many of the pension plans out there, those who offer the OPEB other benefits after retirement, offers health benefits and such a things. But in return, the drug program in specific, that the way the plan worked, that we would offer a drug benefit to retirees, and all the expenses that occur during the year, we would then provide with many of the actuarial data to the federal government, to the state, in order to get a subsidy for against the expenditures that we spend. And we would approximately receive about, you know, in numbers I gave you, that back in 17 or 2018, we received about $20 million, which is even in percentage-wise around the same. But the way employer group waiver program works, that allows that we participate with the federal government, and they are the contracting agencies actually with all the pharmaceutical companies, and they provide us the drugs cost much significantly lower cost. So for example, in the previous program, we would spend $100 and we would get $20 back at the end of the day. Comparatively, under the EGBI program, we would upfront receive a reduced benefit, which is under the EGBI programs of the federal government, we would be spending in not 100 but about $50 at a 50, nearly half. So cost, we would know according to the marketplace what it would be. Had we not gone through and continue the old way, our savings would have been not would not be achieved. With this way, it allows us to not only to pay the reduced cost up front, but also allows us to project and use those savings towards the OPEB liability, which is other post-employment benefits. And for the detailed explanation, I would invite David to probably give a better explanation if I missed it.
Does that help?
It does, and I think that's pretty much all I need to know. I couldn't understand why that happened, but if that's because of the federal infusion of funds, makes that's the answer.
Yeah, it does allow us to, through the chair, Central, and it does allow us to compute the savings for the futures and use towards the OPEB liability, ultimately, which is unfunded, with the help towards the unfunded liability. So when we calculated initially, that savings was at nearly 959. We estimated about rounding up as a $1 billion, but looking at the numbers, that numbers are significantly helping every year, reduction towards the additional state contributions.
Okay. Any other questions for the department? Seeing none, that's good. I'd like to thank the department, or the division, I should say, of retirement benefits for coming forward, helping us through this. We had some good news today on the healthcare trust, so that's always nice to have good news, and we'll continue to work on the unfunded liability of the pension side until we get that rectified. So that'll conclude this morning's meeting. Next meeting will be at 1:30 today. The committee will take up Senate Bill 56, Alaska Performance Scholarship, along with House Bill 26, Council of Alaska Native Languages, and bills previously heard. It'll be chaired by Senator Olson. We are adjourned at 10:54 a.m. We are adjourned.